Slate's coverage of food systems is made possible in part by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Welcome to Slate's Table to Farm. I'm Laura Anderson, Slate's food and drink editor, and joining me here in New York is Dan Pashman, the host of the Sporkful Food Podcast.
Hey, Laura.
Each week in this podcast, we start at the table, we choose a food and investigate where it comes from, and then finally we buy it, cook it, and eat it. Today we are cooking beef.
Yeah, which means I'll eat it. And fortunately, this is a nice big table, and so there's going to be plenty of room for all my beef and plenty of room for you to sit here and watch me eat it.
That's right. So I'm a vegetarian, which means that I won't be eating the beef. I will instead just be watching Dan eat the beef. It'll be a vicarious episode for me. So later on, we're going to go buy some beef at the butcher shop, but we haven't decided which cut of beef to cook yet. First, we wanted to find out more about the life cycle of the typical American cow and the economics of the beef industry. So joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Christopher Leonard. Chris is the Schwartz Fellow at the New America Foundation, and he's a former Associated Press agribusiness reporter. He's now working on a book called The Meat Trust for Simon & Schuster. Hi, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So we're trying to find out where beef that we eat comes from. So can you just walk us through where our cows... First of all, actually, I have a question. Can I refer to them as cows? Is cows the correct term for the animals that we eat?
I am sorry, no. That's not right. If you really want
to... Wow, we're going to need to start for that, like, first grade here. This is really rudimentary stuff if we don't even know what the name of the animal is.
So what should we be calling them then? If we're cattle, I know, is the plural term. What about singular?
Okay, so if you really want to be accurate, if you're talking about the cattle at a feedlot that are about to go into a slaughterhouse, you're talking about steers and heifers. And the steers are the male cattle and the heifers are the female cattle.
So what's a cow?
A cow is a female cattle, okay? It's kind of confusing. So a cow is a female who has had calves and is more than likely producing milk. You would have a dairy cow. But in the industry, if a cow is being raised to be eaten, it's a steer or a heifer.
So we're not talking about cows today. Cows we will reserve for a future episode on dairy. So most cattle these days are still born on ranches, as they have been for a long time, and they spend the first year of their lives in a pasture. After that first year, however, things take a turn, and they usually end up in a feedlot. So tell us, why are feedlots beneficial to the industry?
This is the point in the life cycle where the industry has figured out how to cram a lot of animals together into a kind of factory environment. You can do it now that the animal is older. And I'm sorry, I'm just going to call them cows for the sake of the discussion.
All right, fair enough.
Victory.
We will allow it.
All right, we're going off script here. It's totally unscientific. But so your cow, at this point, they want to fatten it up really quickly. You know, so they go to a feedlot where they just stand around for about 4 months, and they eat a heavy corn-based diet, a grain-based diet that's going to fatten them up really quickly and make the kind of meat that people want to see in a grocery store. And what the industry is pushing toward is standardization.
And when you say standardization, you mean essentially every sirloin in America should look and taste the same.
Exactly.
The role of corn at these feedlots has been covered pretty extensively, so we're not going to get into that in too much detail. But Chris, you've called it the gasoline that fuels these feedlots. And we also learned in the Omnivore's Dilemma that a cow's natural food is grass, not corn, which means that many cows end up sick from eating corn and have to be given antibiotics and other medications, traces of which often end up in the meat. So that's life on the feedlot. What happens next? Who's buying these very large cattle after they've been fattened up?
Okay. This is the part of the industry that really has caught my attention. So you've got these huge feedlots scattered throughout rural America in this kind of belt through the center of the country. And they're huge. I mean, I went to a small one, quote unquote, it had 40,000 head of cattle on it. When it comes time for these big feedlots to sell their cattle, they face a really different picture than that auction barn we just talked about. Four companies buy 83% of all the cattle in the United States. So this feedlot owner, in the best case scenario, has four people bidding for the cattle. In reality, depending on where you're located, you might have one or two big meat packers, maybe three. My reporting has shown in a lot of places, only one person will put in a feasible bid. And it appears that these meat packers kind of divvy up geographic areas, and one meatpacker will come to some kind of agreement, whether spoken or not, that they won't bid competitively in a certain area if that other meatpacker won't bid competitively in their area. So you find these feedlot owners with maybe one feasible bid when they put their cattle up for sale. I think the one critical turn we took that led to where we are today is letting these companies get so enormous. That's been a driving force behind a lot of what we're talking about.
You know, in terms of the industry, I mean, of course, a lot changed with regard to, you know, companies that produce and supply our meat. As you said, these companies are fewer and fewer in number and larger in size, and they've made efficiency and profit their only concern. But I also wonder whether those of us who try to figure out what to serve for dinner each night have also changed the way we think about meat. I mean, like, I think about I don't know if you read David McCullough's book about John Adams, but one of the parts – it's funny. This is the part that stuck with me. But one of the parts that stuck with me was about how John and Abigail Adams were really frugal. And when people came to their house for dinner, they'd serve bread and a bunch of other fillers before they brought out the meat because they didn't want to spend a lot of money on meat. And I even think about a dish like meatloaf, which was basically invented to water down, in quotes, or add bread to meat to make meat last longer. Back in that era, you know, meat was – thought of as more of a precious resource or even an expensive treat. But I feel like nowadays we're kind of accustomed to seeing beef, you know, on every supermarket shelf, every cut there is, half of it on special.
Not to mention, you know, $1 hamburgers at McDonald's.
Right. Thank you, Laura. Not to mention $1 hamburgers at McDonald's. I'm curious, I mean, how do you think that came to be?
Yeah, the I think you described perfectly the major change that's happened. And I heard chicken in the 1930s was like lobster. It was this exotic thing. It was more expensive. So how that happened, I think the biggest driver of that has been when these people in the meat industry figured out how to industrialize and streamline this process. They took a factory mentality and applied it to raising meat. And it was, I mean, it sounds cheesy to call it a revolution, but it was a revolution. It drove down the cost of producing meat radically from like the 1950s until the 1990s. It just became cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and quicker to do it. And so you're dumping, if you will, this cheap meat into the food system, and people are going to buy it. All of a sudden, meat is a lot cheaper. It's not like people are going to turn that down.
So I guess another way to sort of put it is, you know, which came first? Did meat get cheaper or did we value it less? And it sounds like what happened is meat got cheaper and we began to value it less.
I think that's right. But I kind of would like to add a little something in here. Part of my brain wants to say, okay, let's take it back to meat being more expensive and produced in a better way and just make up a smaller portion of our diet. I think a lot of people like that idea. It'd probably be a lot healthier. But for a lot of people, that's not the equation. I mean, a lot of people out there right now are really struggling. And when you talk about really raising the price of meat, I think you've got to keep that in mind because it's, you know, for some people, it'll just be less meat. But for other people, it means, you know, they're having to really skimp on what they feed their family.
Once these mega corporations have bought cattle from feedlots, then what happens to them? I think this is where we're getting to maybe the sadder part of the story.
Yeah, this is, please ask the children to leave the room at this point. This is where it gets really super sad. If we go back to our hypothetical feedlot in Kansas, a big truck is going to come to the feedlot. They're going to pack cattle onto that, and it's going to drive into town where you are going to see an enormous – you can't even call it a slaughterhouse. It's just an enormous multi-acre meat processing plant with a parking lot outside that's bigger than the Walmart parking lot. The cattle go in, and they go into a disassembly line. Nutshell – a cow goes in one end, and then a variety of boxed, coated products that are frozen or refrigerated come out the other end.
And this process is euphemistically called disassembly?
That's what I call it. The industry calls it a processing plant. This is your processing plant.
So, Chris, there's a ton of different labels that you may see on a package of beef in the store or on a restaurant menu. And I want to run through them kind of quickly, a few of them, and I want you to tell me what they mean and if they should impress me.
Okay.
We'll skip grass-fed and corn-fed because we kind of already talked about that. So first, USDA grade A.
I'm not familiar with grade A. There are three basic kinds of meat: choice, prime, and then select. Okay, prime is a steak you're going to get at the restaurant. Choice meat is Walmart, Safeway kind of steaks that it's that middle ground I was talking about, that standardization they're shooting for. And then select is your lower cut of kind of bargain meat.
So actually, another euphemism, it sounds like select is actually the stuff that nobody else selected.
Yes.
Okay.
Stay away from select,
right.
I'm sorry to say.
Well, when I waited tables at a deep dish pizza chain that I shall not name, the steaks in the freezer were labeled grade D butt steaks. am I correct in assuming that those steaks were not of the highest quality?
Yeah, you're correct. grade D, you're not going to have any of your finer cuts.
Okay. All right. Next label, Angus.
Okay. So the Angus is what I call the Model T of beef. I think it's about 80% of all cattle out there now are what you call black Angus. Their coat is totally black, and it's a very kind of predictable quality kind of meat.
If it's 80-something percent of all the beef in the country, then by definition it has to be relatively average.
Right.
And so what about organic meat? Organic beef could have been fed organic corn in an organic feedlot. Is that within the realm of possibility?
I don't want to say it's cosmetic, but it's just sort of changing things around the edges. But the basic structure of the industry can be the same. I mean, organic on its own is not some kind of panacea, and you need to look a lot deeper than just that one word. I think if you want actual, substantive, differently raised beef, you're buying from a local source, basically. You're buying it at the farmer's market or somebody who's got a local community-supported agriculture or CSA.
Great. Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us and for settling the question of what the word cow actually means, along with a lot of many more important questions than that. Chris Leonard is a fellow at the New America Foundation, and he's working on a book about the meat industry for Simon & Schuster. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks a lot. I had a lot of fun.
All right, Laura. So Chris says that if we want to get beef from outside the feedlot system, we should go to a local source. So I think that's what we should do. You got any places in mind?
I do, Dan. I think we should go to Stop It's Market. It's this butcher shop in Brooklyn. It's been in the same location since 1917, and it's super old school. They wear white coats and everything.
Cool. I think it's a good idea. I want to talk to someone who's been doing this for a long time because, you know, we just got the kind of bird's eye view from Chris Leonard of this vast industry. Now, I like the idea of zeroing in on one butcher. This is where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. This is where the beef hits the plate. And I want to find out how the big changes in the beef industry have affected this one butcher and how that affects the steak that's going to end up on my plate here on the table tonight.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you know, we just heard a lot about how conventional beef is raised from Chris Leonard, but I'm really curious about the differences between that conventional beef that's raised and fattened up in a feedlot and the beef that you buy at an independent butcher. What's the difference, really? I mean, it seems like everyone knows that you should go to your local butcher if you want good quality beef. I'm really curious in finding out what exactly is different. How do they process the beef differently? Oh, and we also have to figure out exactly what kind of beef we're going to buy. I'm sort of leaning toward, I think we should maybe go for burgers. It feels like a sort of all-American classic, but I guess we'll have to see what they have there.
You're now holding forth on the correct beef dish for us to be choosing?
You know, I am an American. I'm allowed to have opinions about beef just by virtue of being an American.
All right, I'll check your passport.
Okay.
All right, let's go to the butchers. So, Laura, we're inside Staubitz Market, and they have an amazing selection here. Organic, no hormones, no antibiotics. They even have some other specialty items like blueberry acai gummy pandas. and artisanal
balsamic for onion spread.
Yeah, I don't know if they had that here in 1917.
You never know. We really just can't say.
That's right.
But the main event, obviously, is the meat, and we've got a pretty beautiful array of pork chops, chicken sausage, rib steak. I imagine some of these things are a lot like they were in 1917. All right, so why don't we talk to John McFadden, the butcher?
Hey, John. So how long have you been working here?
I've been working here since I was 12. So it's about 35 years.
You've been working here for 35 years since you were age 12. Did you need to undergo any formal training for this, or you just have been here for so long you learned it all on the job?
I learned as an apprentice. My father, who I learned under, had 4 years of formal schooling and many years of experience. And I was fortunate enough to learn under him.
Have you found that your clientele has changed a lot over the years, since Brooklyn has changed a lot over the years?
Well, yeah, I mean, this part of Brooklyn has changed dramatically. When I first started working here, it was predominantly all Italian. And we did different things. We did, you know, veal cutlets and bracioles and all these, you know, these cuts that are more oriented for an Italian client. Now it's changed, and now it's super gentrified, and it's our store deals mostly with a well-heeled client, people who know food, who like food, who want good food. So, and that's always been the niche that Stalwitz has filled all the years.
So what are they paying for? What's the difference between your meat and the meat that one might buy at, like, a supermarket?
Well, things that you get in a supermarket are going to be, everything's going to be boxed and prefabricated, pre-processed. So when they get it in the supermarket, I don't know how long it's been in a box or vacuum sealed, and they just cut it open and they slice a steak and then they re-vacuum seal again and it goes out onto the shelf and who knows how long it's been sitting around. And their level of quality, it's all commercially raised. So you get things that we call no roll, which means it has no grade whatsoever, or grade very low, like select or choice. Here at Stalbitz, we do prime exclusively. We hand select everything, and that means we go to a market and we hand pick everything. Everything that comes through here has been selected by either myself or my father. In general, we strive to use what's called hanging beef. It's just quarters of primals hanging on a hook and a rail system that we can go. I can touch. I can see it. I can look at the coloring of the meat. I can look at the meat to fat ratio.
And when you make that choice, when you go through that process, what are you looking in the color of the marbleization? What characteristics are you looking for?
High rates of marbleization. The marbling is like that white veining that you see in the meat. The last thing I want to see is a bright red piece of meat that has no marbling in it whatsoever, because it's going to be dry, it's going to be tough, it's going to have no flavor.
And what are you looking for in terms of color?
So coloring, we want to see like a maroonish red to a dark red versus like a super bright fluorescent red. This way I know the meat's been what we call settling. That's the first stages before actually dry aging. So we know that the meat has begun to break down more and has been exposed to oxygen long enough to develop that darker red color.
What does that difference mean in terms of actually the way it's going to taste?
As the meat begins to settle and break down, the meat begins to become softer and also develops a little bit more flavor. Dry aging, some people don't like because they think it becomes too beefy. But here at Stalwitz, that's what we strive for.
We recently ran an article in Slate about a new growth drug that's being used on most cattle that pass through feedlots. And I'm curious whether you buy meat that comes from feedlots. And if not, how you avoid the sort of mass-produced, dry, not very marbled quality that often characterizes American beef.
All of our beef comes from smaller cooperative farms. So they're not organic, but they kind of sign a contract of raising the steers humanely. And within that, it means not just how they're physically treated, but their feed, their sources of water, everything. No hormones, no antibiotics, no steroids. That's our primary source of beef. Then we also do a grass-fed program. And it's similar scenario, but they raise their beef all on grass.
Do you prefer personally corn-fed or grass-fed beef?
That's a good question. A lot of people tell you that they don't like grass-fed because it tends to be a little more not tough, but a little more of a chew, as we say. And you know, you have some of the grassy overtones in the meat while you're eating it. I think, you know, I was born and raised on corn-fed beef, and which is most people in America are raised on. So we have developed, you know, a palate for that. But I think that there's room for people to experiment and open up. And there's some great grass-fed beef out there. I don't think it has to be one or the other.
It's interesting you mentioned, you know, that you and so many Americans have been raised on corn-fed beef. And then you're talking about the contracts you have signed with the small farmers. And then I'm thinking back to the way you guys did things, I assume, 35 years ago. And I'm curious whether it's more that Brooklyn got gentrified and your customers wanted their meat from farms where these types of contracts have been signed and wanted grass-fed beef. Or is it more that, like, you guys have always essentially been doing it that way and it's the larger system that's changed?
Well, you're kind of right in a way. I started bringing naturally raised products into the store about 20 years ago. Because it was something I was interested in. I wanted to just constantly, you know, we're striving to always bring a better product to market. Unfortunately, I think I was ahead of the curve. Because when I first started bringing things in, people showed no interest in it whatsoever. As a matter of fact, I remember bringing in cold cuts without nitrates in them, and nobody wanted them. People would make comments like, give me the one with the nitrates. I like the nitrates. And so I went through these waves where I'd get excited about it. I'd introduce it, and it would just like wax and wane. And eventually I kind of stopped doing it. And then at some point, I'd say 10 years ago, people started coming in and asking me, started saying, can you get me this? Can I get an all-natural product? And so I was so excited, and finally it would open up the market, and we have been going full tilt ever since.
So Dan and I are going to be making burgers, and so please tell us how we should make our burgers.
Are we definitely making burgers? Because there's so much good stuff here, Laura. And Laura, by the way, John, Laura is a vegetarian. So I'm going to be eating whatever it is that we buy. So I would like to get something that's going to look as also not only just taste, but look as delicious as possible, so that when Laura watches me eat it, there's a little tiny part of her that just questions her entire approach to life.
Well, so are
okay, so I take it back. Not burgers, but something that will make me question my entire approach to life.
Do you have that on the menu?
Let me check that one. I think steak comes to mind, like just a nice juicy steak. I mean, actually, right in front of me, the rib roast is where the rib steak comes from. This steak is my favorite steak. I love the fact that it's super oxygenated because it's close to the lungs. It's got this beautiful red color. It's got great marbling in it. Plenty of fat's going to keep it juicy. Even if I make an error and cook it a couple minutes too long, it's very forgiving. It's delicious.
What would you say is one of the more underrated cuts out there that maybe it's not as expensive, it's not as well known, but you think it's got a lot of potential?
There is a piece that's called a tri-tip steak.
Yes. I asked the same question to a butcher in upstate New York 6 months ago, and he said tri-tip.
Yeah, it's we joke about it, we call it the poor man's rib steak. Because it just has a lot of marbling in it. The muscle texture is different than a rib. It's longer striated muscle tissue, so you have to cut it against the grain. But it's got a lot of internal marbling, so it's very rich in flavor. And if you can find it, it's relatively, you know, reasonable in price.
And how would you recommend people cook it?
High heat situation, so in a broiler or on a grill.
What do you think, Dan?
I want to try the tri-tip, first of all, because I've only had it a couple times, and I have heard a lot of people talking about it. And second of all, because Laura, I think, is less turned off by meat when it seems less like a piece of an animal. And I think
that's
a tri-tip.
Really, I'm not grossed out by meat. It's really, like, meat looks delicious to me. It's not the fact that it looks like it comes from an animal.
So what is it?
The fact that it actually came from an animal.
So it's not the appearance, it's just the
right,
knowledge
exactly.
That you can't erase from your brain.
Yeah. That said, go please. I look forward to your attempts to convert me to eating meat with this tri-tip steak.
Okay, John, what would you do if your son wanted to be a vegetarian?
Well, that's fine. He's eight now. I'd say 2 years ago, he started questioning pork chops and where they come from. And I think he saw something with pigs, and he said, "Does it come from a pig? Is that, was that alive?" And I thought, "Oh, we're going down this road." And
you're like, "Sure, you don't want to know where babies come from?"
And I thought, "Well, you know, this is his choice to make." Although he was only 6 years old, but
anyway. So can you tell me about that conversation? What did you say, and how did he respond?
I was honest. I told him exactly that what it was. It was alive at one time, and they were raised for the purposes of giving us a food, and this is where our food comes from. And he was quiet, and he looked at me, and the next night I think my wife served pork chops, and I thought, what's going to happen here? And he started eating it, and he said to me, "Dad, pig tastes good." That was it. So I'm not worried about it just now.
All right, John, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That is good.
This water I'm drinking is delicious. So we're back at the table with this beautifully cooked tri-tip steak. And Dan, your steak actually looks pretty good. Although, unfortunately, it has not converted me back to meat eating. But I have to ask, how is it? I know you hadn't tried the tri-tip before.
It is really, really good. I did take a nice picture of it sliced open in all of its meat juice glory.
Mm.
So if you want to join Laura in eating my steak vicariously by looking at pictures of it, check out our show page at slate.com/tabletofarm. The tri-tip really impressed me. The idea, when you first see the cut, you see these long striations that are reminiscent of a corned beef brisket type of a cut of beef, which is considered a lower quality. You know, you would never grill a brisket. Usually those types of meat are cooked slow and low to soften them up. And the sort of selling point of the tri-tip is that it is kind of the quality of a sirloin at the price of these lower grade cuts. But I found that it cooked up really nicely. And I really decided to challenge the tri-tip because—
So wait, what does that mean? How did you challenge the tri-tip?
Well, what it means is that I decided to cook it on very high heat. I showed it no mercy. Other people will cook it in a crock pot, in a slow cooker, like you would with a lower quality cut of meat. I actually considered doing tri-tip two ways. I was thinking I would put half of it in the slow cooker and cook half on a high temperature to contrast them. I didn't end up having time to do that. But I didn't even rub it. I just put on olive oil, salt, and pepper.
You were not going to let it hide behind any other flavors at all.
That's right. That's
and
right.
So, and it turned out pretty well?
It turned out really well. I cooked it on high flame in a cast iron pan for a couple minutes on each side. I even sort of stood it up on the thin edges. And that creates a seal. Put it in the oven at 425 for about 20 minutes, maybe 25 minutes. And the nice thing about the tri-tip, the tri denotes that it is somewhat triangular in shape. And so you have a more narrow end and a wider end, which was great for my wife and me because she likes her meat more medium, medium rare. I like it more really rare. And so I was able to cook it so that the wider end was rare and the narrow end was more medium rare.
How convenient that you got the end that contains more meat.
Don't hate the player, hate the game. All right, Laura.
And so it wasn't like, you know, stringy or tough at all?
It was not. I mean, look, it wasn't quite as tender as your truly high-end piece of steak, but it was tender. The marbleization on the steak was really superb. Overall, Laura, this was a great steak.
Well, I can't argue with that.
No, you can't. You can't. You literally cannot argue with it.
Well, that about does it for us this week. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Laura.
Dan's food podcast is called The Sporkful. You can search for it on iTunes or find it at sporkful.com. You can also get Dan's tri-tip recipe and find more links from today's show on our show page at slate.com/tabletofarm. Join us next week when we'll be cooking apples, talking to a self-described apple nerd, and playing a game called Apple Variety or New England Town.
Are you up to the task, Laura?
I think I am.